Osman Atalan waited in the village of Metemme for shattered divisions of his Jarlan allies to reassemble, for their sheikhs to come to him and place themselves under his command. But their own emir, Salida, and all his sons were dead. So brave when he led them, they were now like children without a father. Allah had deserted them. The cause was lost. They disappeared back into their desert fastnesses. Osman waited in vain. At first light the next morning, he called for the master of the pigeons. "Bring me three of your fastest and swiftest birds," he ordered. With his own hand, he wrote out his message for the Mahdi in triplicate, one copy to be carried by each bird. If falcons or other misfortune struck one or even two, the vital message would still reach the holy man in Omdurman. "To the Mahdi, Muhammad Ahmed, may Allah protect and cherish him. You are the light of our eyes and the breath of our bodies. My shame and sadness is a great rock in my belly, for know you that the infidel has prevailed in battle against us. Emir Salida is dead and his division destroyed. The infidel has reached the Nile at Metemme. I am returning in all haste with my division to Omdurman. Pray for us, holy and mighty Mahdi." The pigeon master tied the folded messages to the legs of the birds, replaced them in their basket, and carried them to the river bank. Osman went ahead of him. The pigeon master handed the birds to him one at a time. Before he launched them, Osman held each in his cupped hands and blessed it. "Fly swiftly and straight, little friend. May Allah protect you." He tossed the bird into the air and it rose on the clatter of wings, circled the little village of Metemme, then picked up its bearings and shot away on rapid wing beats into the south. He let each pigeon get well clear before he sent away the next, lest they should form a flock that would attract the attention of the predators. When they were gone, he walked back to the village and climbed the mud dome of the mosque. From the top balcony of the prayer tower, whence the muezzin called the faithful to their devotions, he had a full view of both banks of the river. The cluster of small white steamers was still anchored downstream in the pool of the crocodiles. They were beyond his reach, for he had no artillery with which to attack them. Instead, he turned his attention to the British camp. With the naked eye, he could make out the men within the walls of their hastily constructed zareba. They had not yet made any effort to begin loading the steamers with either men or equipment. He wondered at their curious lethargy. It was much at variance with the energy and urgency they had displayed until now. If their goal was still to reach and relieve Khartoum as swiftly as possible, they should have left their wounded on the river bank, embarked their fighting men, and sailed southwards without an hour's delay. "Perhaps Allah has not yet forsaken us. Perhaps he will help me to reach the city ahead of these unpredictable men," he murmured. He went down from the tower to where the remnants of his division were waiting for him on the outskirts of the village. The horses and camels were already saddled and loaded, and Al-Nur held his new steed. It was a big black stallion, the strongest animal in his string. Osman stroked the white blaze on his forehead. His name was Al-Buk, the war trumpet. "You are without vice, Buk," he whispered, "but you could never match Hulumaya." He looked back up the dunes to where she had fallen. The vultures and the crows still circled over the ridge. Will there ever be another animal as noble as she, he wondered, and the black tide of his anger flooded the depths of his being. "Abd al-Rijji, you have much to atone for." He swung up into the saddle and raised his clenched right fist. "In the name of Allah, we ride for Omdurman," he cried, and his agajirs thundered after him.